Barbot is from the University of Florida, Gainesville. Laura got her PhD in Heidelberg a few years ago. She worked on a Heidelberg-Moscow neutrinoless double beta decay experiment. Who's looking for neuronal massive neutrinos? Then she moved to Stanford as a postdoc and started working on searches for cold dark matter, which is the subject of her talk today. And a few years ago, she moved to the University of Florida, and she decided that Florida wasn't warm enough for her, and so she moved back to Europe. And kindly welcome.
Right, Europe is a little warmer. Okay. Thank you. Okay, so I'm going to talk about searches for cold relics of the early universe, namely for dark matter. And as most of you, I'm sure, know, this is what I call the cosmic food chain. In the last decade or so, we think we have a pretty good model of the universe, if you want. We think we know what it's made of. We see if that is actually true. But anyway, we think that we know that about 4% is made of ordinary matter, such as stars and gas and people and intergalactic gas and so on. We also think that we have good evidence that about 23% of the energy and matter content of the universe is made of cold dark matter, and that's going to be the subject of my talk today. And most of the part seems to be made of something that's even more peculiar, and we don't really have a good clue on what it could be. We call it dark energy. It could be a cosmological constant or something similar, or maybe none of this is true here, but for today, let's assume that we do have dark matter. You know, we may not understand gravity, or there could be something even weirder out there, but let's see what is the evidence for dark matter. Okay, so dark matter in galaxies, what we measure here is the rotation curves, and let's see what we expect. This is what we expect if you plot the velocity as a function of the orbital radius, okay? You expect this rise here because you have the stars in the central region where the mass grows with r the third power, so the velocity will grow with r, and then as you go further and further out, and if your entire mass, say, is concentrated in the visible part of the galaxy, okay, you expect this Keplerian fall here, right, with 1 over square root of r. And this is not what is measured. So observations of interstellar gas at large radii and also of satellite galaxies and so on give these rotation velocity curves for thousands and thousands of galaxies, and they can explain by assuming a halo of dark matter that's much larger than the visible part of the galaxy, and it contains about 10 times more mass or so than in the visible part. Okay? And you can explain all these rotation curves that were measured with one single parameter, that's the luminosity, for example. You have something that's called universal rotation curves. Now, what about dark matter in clusters? So this guy here, Fritz Zwicky, was the first one, actually, that came up with evidence for this type of dark matter by looking at the velocity dispersion of galaxies in the Coma cluster and applying the Virial theorem. You can then get the total mass, okay, if you measure R and this term here. And for the Coma cluster, it turned out that the mass over light ratio was about 300 times the one that's true for the Sun. Now, this method is still used today to estimate the mass of clusters. However, you also have other methods, okay, independent ones. One of them is to study the X-ray emission that traces the distribution of this hot intracluster gas. This is an image here of a cluster, an optical one, and this is an X-ray image. Okay, so if you assume that it's in hydrostatic equilibrium and it's all this gas must be bound by something in the cluster, then you can infer its total mass. And by knowing how much mass is in baryons, or the upper limit, say, from Big Bang nucleosynthesis, you can come up with an estimate for the total cluster mass, and all these estimates give something like 30 or 35%. Another independent method that has been used to infer masses of clusters is gravitational lensing. As you know, light is propagating along geodesics, which will deviate from straight lines when you have a strong or intense gravitational field there, and a strong gravitational field is given by such a cluster, for instance, and you look at the distortion of this, of the image of background objects, okay, of galaxies that are in the background, and from these shapes here, you can actually reconstruct then the total mass of the cluster. And this here is such a reconstruction where the individual spikes here are the individual galaxies, but you see that the underlying mass distribution is much larger. Now, amazingly, if you want, all these methods seem to deliver more or less the same answer, that about a third of the mass is in dark matter. I won't be talking about this, but we also have evidence from cosmological scales. Okay, we cannot reproduce the observed large-scale structures if you don't assume a dark matter component. And also, WMAP gives us another measurement of the, if you want, of the total of omega zero, the total mass energy content. Okay. But let's go back to galaxies. So we are in a galaxy. That's where we want to look for dark matter. And we are interested in how much, what is the local density, if you want. Okay. So where do we get the local density from? Namely, from the measured rotation curve of the Milky Way. This is the measured rotation curve of the Milky Way. It's not as well measured as for other galaxies because we are in the galaxy. So we have pretty large errors here. And an acceptable range here of for the dark matter density in our galaxy is something from 0.2 to 0.8 GeV per cubic centimeter. So there's quite a large error here associated with it, depending on your halo model and so on. Okay. So we don't know this number precisely. This is something that at some point we'd like to measure. Now, apart from these cosmological observations, we also have motivation from particle physics. Okay. As we all know, the standard model is very successful, but it's not complete. We have one experimental evidence that there's more than the standard model, namely neutrinos seem to be massive. They change flavor. There are also some theoretical problems. One of them is the chirality problem. Why is this scale so much smaller than the Planck scale, for instance? And we think we can solve some of the problems with new physics at the weak scale. Okay. And some popular extensions, there are many others here that I won't mention, are supersymmetry. We'll talk a little more about it. That gives us a good dark matter candidate in form of the lightest supersymmetric particle or the neutralino. And also models with universal extra dimensions where you can also have a good dark matter candidate, namely, for instance, the first Kaluza-Klein excitation of the photon. But these are just examples for a more generic type of particle that is called a WIMP, a weakly interacting massive particle. Okay, and let's see why we think that WIMPs are such good dark matter candidates. So this is an argument that has been made mid-80s perhaps or so and has been part of the driving force behind this dark matter experiments, if you want. So if you have a weakly interacting massive particle that existed in the early universe, then this reaction can happen in both directions, okay? It can annihilate into fermion-antifermion pairs and other stuff, and the reaction is in equilibrium as long as the reaction rate, is below the expansion rate, okay? So you're somewhere up here. However, when the reaction rate drops below the expansion rate, okay, then you have this exponential drop here, and if you were in equilibrium all the time, then you would be left with no relic density at all. However, because equilibrium here is not the entire story, okay, your particle will freeze out, if you want, and you are left with a relic density. And the larger the annihilation cross-section, the smaller your relic density will be. Okay, you can calculate by solving the Boltzmann equation and so on that this relic density will be inverse proportional to your annihilation cross-section. Hmm. Now, the nice thing here is that if you plug in, if you say, okay, I want this the relic density to be of the order of 0.2 or so to solve this dark matter problem, then annihilation cross-sections are of the order of 1 picobarn or so, or weak cross-sections. Okay? And on dimensional grounds, if you if you write this here in this way, okay, as alpha square over m square, then the mass associated with this scale is also weak scale mass is something between, say, 10 to 1, 10 GeV to 1 TeV or so. And the question is this just a coincidence? Okay, if omega is relevant for cosmology, then we get here such a weakly interacting massive particle. Or does it tell us something deeper? So what we think is that this new physics, whatever it is, that's responsible for electroweak symmetry breaking, will give rise to a dark matter candidate. And these predictions, the good thing about them is also that these candidates can actually be explored, both in astrophysics experiments and in the accelerator experiments as well. Okay? There are lots of other dark matter candidates that I'm not going to talk about, and many of them cannot actually be detected at all. So supersymmetry, as many of you know, it's a new fundamental space-time symmetry that relates fermions to bosons, so standard model particles get super partners. And to prevent rapid proton decay, you have a discrete symmetry or R parity that's plus one for standard model particles, minus one for supersymmetric particles. If this is conserved, that means that particles can only decay into an odd number of particles, and it also means then the lightest supersymmetric particle will be stable. And naturally, is a dark matter candidate, and most of the time, it is a linear combination here of the Biino, Viino, and the two neutral Higgs Zenos. Now, another, as I said before, another dark matter candidate comes from these universal extra dimensions, where you allow all standard model particles to propagate into flat extra dimensions that show up around 1 TeV or so. And as it was shown already by Kaluza and Klein, for each standard model particle, you get an infinite tower of partner states with the same quantum numbers. And m square will depend on this here, n square over r square, and n0 are the standard model particles. Okay. Now, from the translational invariance along the fifth dimension, if you have, say, one extra dimension only, you get a discrete symmetry that's conserved, that's called Kaluza-Klein parity. And that means that the lightest Kaluza-Klein mode here is stable, and it cannot decay into a standard model particle. Okay. So this gives you also an excellent dark matter candidate that's phenomenologically very similar, if you want, to the LSP. However, the underlying model is very different. As I will show you, the experiments that we are building, even if you detect such a particle, there's no way to tell the difference, okay, between the LSP and LKP, if you want. So you need accelerators for that. Now, WIMPs, 10 to the 6 per second, go now through your thumb, without you noticing it, or if you do, let me know. 10, I can use you as a detector, maybe. 10 to the 15 goes through your body every day, and very few will interact, okay? So if their interaction is then so weak, the question is, how can we detect them? Now, there are different ways, and as we showed, they are all complementary to each other, so we can make them in accelerators, okay? This here happens in the early universe. Then by crossing symmetry, you can also produce them, and that's the goal of Tevatron run and also of the future LHC experiment, or one of the goals, to perhaps create such particles in the lab and measure their properties. You can also try to image the sun's core or look at the galactic center or in the halo. We'll talk a little bit more about this later. But again, if they annihilated in the early universe, they can annihilate today also if you look at regions that are dense enough to have accumulated dark matter, okay? And such these regions could be, for instance, the core of the sun or the galactic center. And we'll see later on how signatures would look like. Or you can also go to Minnesota. Again, by crossing symmetry, these particles will also scatter off quarks, okay? And because they are actually very slow, they're moving non-relativistically today, they will effectively scatter on nuclei, okay? Now, why do you go to Minnesota, for instance, deep down an old iron mine? Because you want to shield your experiment from cosmic rays, or if you're in Canada, you go to Snow Lab, of course. cosmic rays would induce a background in your experiment that's millions of times, if you want, higher than the signal you're looking for. Okay, so the deeper the better. We'll see later on what it is. So that's a very simplified sketch of direct detection. Okay, a WIM comes in. It moves very slowly. It scatters elastically with your nucleus in your target material. And the rate, a rough number for the rate you can get here, by which it will be proportional to the number of target nuclei in your detector, to the local WIM density, and to the scattering cross-section. Okay, so you know, you need to know these quantities. Now, because this elastic scattering, as I mentioned, happens in the extreme non-relativistic limit, because these particles are so slow, if you write down the effective Lagrangian, you will end up with two important interactions here, two important couplings, namely the spin-spin interaction, whereas if the particle, if the dark matter particle has spin, it could couple to the spin of your nucleus, if your nucleus has spin, or scalar interaction, where it couples to the mass of your nucleus. Okay? And as I said, the event rate, this is the event rate here, the differential rate will depend on the local WIM density on the cross-section. It will also depend on the velocity distribution. Most of the time it's assumed that these particles are Maxwellian-Boltzmann distributed. We don't really know. We kind of know this from n-body simulation, but you can imagine somewhat more complicated velocity distributions as well. And then the recoil spectrum will look something like that, so it's a pretty featureless, which doesn't help a lot, as we'll see. And what's also important is the energy that's deposited in your detector, right? So you can calculate it, and it's very, very low. It's mostly below, actually, 50 kV or so. So you will look for something that's pretty featureless in a very low energy region. Okay, so that's a little difficult. And to see what you expect here in different detectors, we will be comparing different materials that you use to look for this WIM, such as germanium, for instance, or neon or xenon. Okay, the event rate is also suppressed by this form factor. Okay, that's simply the Fourier transform of your nuclear density, and for heavier nuclei here, it kicks in earlier. Okay, so around the, I don't know, 50 or 100 kV already. So what's important here, for instance, if you have a heavy nucleus, in the case of iodine or xenon, to have a very low energy threshold, okay? Your event rate scales with A squared, so that helps to have a heavy nucleus. On the other side, you have this form factor suppression, so you have to find a material that's a compromise between both. Now, what are these detection techniques? So what you want to measure is the small recoil energy that's deposited in your detector by a WIM that scatters off a nucleus, okay? So you can look at phonons. You can have a certain material and try to measure the lattice excitations or the charge or the light, okay, scintillation. And there are many experiments that try to do exactly this, and some of the experiments actually can measure two of those. Phonons and light, or light and charge and phonons. And why is that important? As I'll show you later, it turns out that the ratio between, say, phonon and charge depends on the type of interaction. Mm-hmm. I mean, you will ask me if something scatters off a nucleus, or if there is a small energy deposition in my detector, how can I know that it comes from a WIMP and not from something else? Okay. So first of all, you have lots of background, even if you go deep, even if you are very careful and so on, from electromagnetic interactions, from gammas, electrons, and so on. And those you can all discriminate against by looking at the ratio of two of these, because the ratio will be different for electron recoils than for nuclear recoils. So your ultimate background are neutrons, okay? Because neutrons induce the same signal as a WIMP. Now, the good thing is you can use neutrons to calibrate your detector. On the other side, again, if you see a signal, will you be able to tell whether it's a neutron or a WIMP? You will, for instance, if you use two different materials. And that's what we do in CDMS. We use germanium and silicon. Since the event rate will scale for WIMP scales with A square, if you see actually a signal from a dark matter, then you would expect a much higher signal in germanium than in silicon, while if you just measure neutron background, that won't be the case. Okay? And another, apart from shielding against neutrons and so on, another way of measuring the neutron flux is to look at multiple scatters. So neutrons will multiple scatter if you have an array of detectors, while WIMPs, the interaction cross-section is so low that the chance of multiple scattering is just vanishing. So this is what I call the worldwide WIMP search, just to give you an idea. There are lots of experiments out there, I think more than 20, that look for this type of particles, and I won't cover all of them. Okay, here in Canada there's Picasso, CDMS, North America, then there's the Grand Sasso Lab, where there are quite a few dark matter experiments, Can Frank, the Bowlby mine in UK, and so on. So where do we stand right now? Before we go into a little bit more detail, so I will show you a lot of plots that look like this. So what we show here on the y-axis is the cross-section of these particles normalized to a nucleon. And why do you want to normalize it? Just to be able to compare different experiments. Okay, that's why you're not showing event rates for, say, germanium or silicon or so. So you normalize per nucleon, and you can compare, say, an experiment that uses germanium with an experiment that uses sodium iodine. Now, the current best limit comes from CDMS. This is a 2005 result, so everything that's above here is excluded, all this parameter space, okay? If you would have a WIMP, say, with this cross-section here and this mass, we should have seen it already in CDMS. This was the situation here with Heidelberg-Moscow that was actually also used to look for dark matter in 98. And there is, in fact, one experiment that claims that they see a positive signal. That's the DAMA experiment in Gran Sasso. They use sodium iodine detectors, 100 kilograms. However, none of the other experiments was able to confirm it. Okay, this is an experiment that's based on liquid xenon that's called Zeppelin in the OK mine. This one is the Edelweiss experiment that's very similar to CDMS, and we will talk a little bit more about CDMS that operates in the Modan laboratory. Okay. So none of these experiments could actually see any evidence for DAMA signal. Now, because cryogenic experiments are leading the field, let's talk about them in a little bit more detail. So cryogenic experiments are phonon-mediated detectors. So you want to detect the thermal or the fast phonons after we interact in the absorber. Okay, so you have an absorber that's made of a certain material. You have here your reservoir, a temperature reservoir, you have a link between the two, and you want to measure a change in temperature, okay, of your absorber. So a deposited energy will change the temperature, and the temperature change can be written down like this here, where this here is the heat capacity. Okay. Now you may remember from your undergraduate studies that for pure dielectric crystals and superconductors, a temperature is way below the transition temperature, that this goes with the power, the third power of the temperature, okay, the heat capacity. So what does this mean? Well, it means that the lower the temperature, the larger this delta T per unit of absorbed energy. That means you need to go to very low temperatures, to millikelvin, say, to measure microkelvin changes, okay, in the temperature. And how can you measure these temperature changes? There are different ways, and I'm going to talk only about one, namely transition edge sensors with electrothermal feedback. So again, this is your absorber. In the case of CDMS, it's germanium. You have the thermal link here. This is your dilution refrigerator, okay? And then you place here a transition edge sensor that's a superconducting, very, very thin film. And what you do, you are placing a bias voltage across your film, and you will reach equilibrium when ohmic heating here will be balanced by the heat flow into your absorber, okay? Now, let's assume that you have an interaction here. You create phonons, and then they will propagate to the surface and reach the transition edge sensor, okay? Then the resistance of your film will increase, and because you voltage biased your sensor, E will decrease by delta E, and also the Joule power will decrease. However, you get a feedback signal because this here is constant. Namely, you will get a change in this Joule power heating the film, okay? So you're basically measuring the deposited energy by using this here, delta E of T. And this is how it looks like. So you need to choose the appropriate voltage and also the appropriate film resistivity, and you can achieve stable operation. So So let's say that this is a, you have here a very steep transition. This is a superconducting regime. This is a normal conducting one. And you want the temperature of your substrate to be somewhere here so that you operate in this steep transition part, okay? And as I said, this electrothermal feedback will give you a response of your detector, and you measure this change in current. It's a very small change that you need to measure with a squid. And the good thing about this is also that it's a very fast response. Okay, so there are other ways to measure the phonons, to measure the thermal phonons, but that involves something that's called neutron transmitted germanium detectors or some other type of sensors that are much slower, that are on the scales of milliseconds or so, while here you're talking about microseconds. Now, the CDMS experiment is at the Sudan mine in Minnesota. This is a map of some of the underground laboratories. So you see here the muon intensity versus depth. So most of the, all the hadronic component of the cosmic rays and so on is shielded by already by 10 meter watt equivalent or so. However, the penetrating component are the muons, of course. And these muons will interact in your shield or in the walls of your cavern and whatnot and create high-energy neutrons. So that's why you want to go deeper to actually be shielded against those high-energy neutrons, okay? So the deeper, the better. Sudan, as you see here, it's not that deep, but it's already 2,000 meter watt equivalent. The experiment before was at the Stanford underground facility with 17 meter watt equivalent, so very shallow. And we reduced the neutron flux from one event per kilogram day to one per kilogram year. Okay, so that's not bothering us at this stage of the experiment. However, for larger versions, as we see, you need to go even deeper. This is Sudbury here. This would be the nozzle, the home stake, if it's going to be built. This is Gran Sasso. So CDMS detectors, as I said, the absorber is a crystal of germanium and silicon. Okay, they're 1 centimeter thick here and 7.5 in diameter. And the temperature sensors, these transitional sensors, these are photographically patterned thin films of aluminum and tungsten at the surface. Okay, you see here, this is actually the transitional sensor, the tungsten. So apart from measuring these phonons, we have here four channels. We also measure the charge. So we apply a small voltage across the crystal, okay, and then you measure, you drift the electron holes. It's a semiconductor, and you also measure the small charge signal when a particle interacts in your detector. And why is that? Because it gives you this powerful discrimination or identification of your event, if you want. So what we use is something that we call ionization yield. That's simply charge divided by phonon, okay? So if you divide here charge by phonon as a function of the total recoil energy, that's the phonon, that's the energy in the phonon channel, you will see two bands, okay? This data were taken with calibration sources. So you see here what we call the gamma band, where you have electron recoils. They all have this ionization yield, say, around 1, or you set it to be 1. And then the nuclear recoils here taken with a neutron source are have an ionization yield of about a third. Okay, the entire energy of your nuclear recoil will go into phonons, but only about a third of this energy goes into charge. So that's why you have this difference. There's a slight problem, however, namely events that interact very close to the surface of your detector, very shallow, say betas or surface electrons, well, you lose part of the charge, okay? You're not collecting the entire charge. That means that this ionization yield will be suppressed, will not be 1, but will be smaller than 1, and some of these events may leak into your signal region. So if you went to Sudan or to SNOLAB or wherever, and you don't care at all about neutron background because, say, it's 0, you need to care about the surface event background. And I'll show you how you can get rid of it. Namely, by looking at the timing of your events, okay? So using the phonon rise time and the charge to phonon delay, so this is, I told you we have four phonon sensors on one of the surfaces of the crystal, and these are the four phonon pulses, and this is a charge pulse here that's much faster. So by looking at the delay between the arrival times of the charge and the phonon, if you want, you can now plot this delay versus what I call ionization yield. So you would have these bands here. And all these events that happen at the surface have much faster delays, okay? So if you do a cut in this plane, say this would be a simplified cut here, you do a cut in ionization yield and one in the timing parameter, you keep most of your signal, but you get rid of all your electromagnetic background, okay? So that's, and that allows a discrimination of better than 99.99 whatever percent against your background. So right now at Sudan, this is how it looks most of the time, the entrance to the mine. And some people are asking us, why do we need a dilution refrigerator? And don't leave the detectors outside. So we have now, this is what we call the ice box or our cryostat. And we have, you see here only the top of them, five so-called towers installed in there. One tower has six detectors. Okay. So in total we have 19 germanium and 11 silicon detectors. And just some picture of the experiment. This is the dilution refrigerator. This is this ice box as it was closed. And you start building up the shield surrounding it. So you have poly shield, layers of poly against neutrons, and layers of lead against gammas. Then you close everything up, and then you surround it 4 pi with a muon veto. So because even though you're deep, you will still have muons that are penetrating, and you want a veto, okay? All the events that are where you see a nuclear recoil in your detector that's coincident with a muon, that's clearly not a dark matter signal. And the data were taken in 2 runs with 2 towers. We just installed the 5 towers. We haven't started taking data yet, so we took data with 12 detectors here, 2 towers. And I'm going to talk about the latest results that were published in 2005, namely taken from March 2004 to August 2004 with 6 germanium and 6 silicon detectors. Okay, so we take lots of calibration data with gamma and neutron sources and develop our cuts blind, and then when we think that everything looks good, then we open the box and apply these cuts to the WIMP search data. And this is here the WIMP search data and all the detectors taken together before these timing cuts that I was showing you that gets rid of events that happen at the surface, and this is here after the timing cuts, okay? And there's only one candidate here, a 10.5 kV recoil energy that is, however, consistent with the background. So we don't assume this is from dark matter, but it's actually one of these events, one of the surface events that leaks into here, okay? It's consistent with our predicted background from statistics and systematics. And what we do, we can also give a limit then. Okay, so we improve our limit. This was the last one in 2004 by about a factor of 4 or 5 or so. Okay, and we exclude all this region here. So the good news is that these are all SUSY predictions from supersymmetry, that you are actually now cutting into this parameter space. Okay? However, as I show you, this is not the entire story. Of course, it goes down in cross section. It's almost bottomless, but anyway, we at least start to test it, and we don't see any evidence. If Dama were right, we should see a huge number of events by this time. Okay. Now, we also these were limits for spin independent, for coherent cross sections. Okay. You can also put limits on pure neutron or pure proton coupling, and it's just easier to show it like that. In this case, you say, okay, the proton coupling is zero and vice versa. Now, although we use natural germanium and silicon, we have some sensitivity to spin because we have 73 germanium here, 7.73%, and 29 silicon, that's only about 5%. But both contain a single unpaired neutron, okay? So our limit on pure neutron couplings of these particles will be better than the one here. And this is the latest limit from the germanium, and this is from the silicon data. And this is because there are some papers out there claiming that perhaps you can save Dama if you say, okay, they see a WIMP that couples only via spin, okay, and nothing else. But as you see, that's not the case, okay? It's excluded here by CDMS and some other experiments. And even here, it is mostly excluded, in fact, by Super Kamiokande, and we get to that, by an indirect detection experiment, okay? If WIMPs would interact mostly via couplings to protons, then you would have a high capture rate in the sun because the sun is made out of protons, and then Super Kamiokande should see a signal from wimp annihilation in the sun. And as I'll show you later on, they don't see such a signal. Now we have five towers. We hopefully start we are commissioning now the five towers. Hopefully we'll start taking data in the next month or so. And this is where we want to get in 2007. So to improve our limit, or maybe to find something, who knows, by a factor of 10. And then we also have a proposal for super CDMS that would build 25 kilogram, 150, and 1 ton of these experiments, okay? And cover, say, if not all, but at least a large part of this predicted parameter space. So where do we stand in terms of event rates? So this here corresponded to about one event per kilogram day, okay? Where CDMS is now, it corresponds to about 0.1 event per kilogram day. We want to go to one event per kilogram year. However, if we deal with such very low cross sections, then obviously we need 1 ton to detect 10 events per year, right? And that's not very surprising if you think a little bit about neutrino physics and about the cross sections involved there that are larger. And yet people use kiloton experiments to look for neutrinos. However, the agencies get scared if they even hear of a 100 kilogram dark matter experiment. So anyway, there are lots of projects out there to build larger dark matter experiments, and I'm not going to talk about all of them, but there is the super CDMS that I mentioned, Eureka, that's a very similar European effort, leakage xenon experiments, Zeppelin, MAX, and xenon. There's one experiment in the Bowlby mine. They have now a prototype that actually tries to measure the direction of the incoming recoil, okay, because that would give you a strong signature telling you, okay, this comes really from a wimp that's out there in the halo. There are some proposals to build leak and argon experiments. And there are also some proposals, and I mentioned here only Picasso, to build experiments based on superheated droplets. This would make use of the fluorocarbons here, and the active material is 19 fluorine. Okay, these are just mini bubble chambers, if you want. Okay, so they have about 10 to 100 microns in diameter, and they are suspended in some kind of a water-based gel, and depending on dE over dx, you get a phase transition. Okay, and then you can adjust your temperature and pressure so that you get a phase transition or your bubble burst, say, only if you have a nuclear recoil, but not if you have an electron recoil, okay? So if you want this by adjusting T and P, these experiments are basically background-free, apart, of course, from all the stuff that can induce a nuclear recoil, such as also alpha particles. However, they have now a few grams, and they plan to operate soon 1 kilogram of this type of detectors. But very promising looks leakage xenon. And why is that so? So let's talk about a little bit about xenon. Namely, it has a high atomic mass that's favorable for a spin-independent case. It has a high atomic number and a high density. That's good because it allows you to build a compact detector, okay? A 100-kilogram detector is something like that, so it doesn't blow up. Available in large quantities at reasonable cost. It's not very cheap, like argon, but it's, you know, you can buy it. Much easier cryogenics than for super CDMS. You don't need to cool your 1 ton to millikelvin, but only to minus 100 Celsius. You don't have any long-lived radioactive xenon isotopes, except this one that's a double beta decay emitter. That's actually good because you may also measure the neutrinos double beta decay. You have a high photon and a high charge yield, and you have both spin and non-spin isotopes. Now, what are the basic processes here? So as I explained, in CDMS, we look for phonons and charge. Well, here we look for light and charge. And again, the ratio of light to charge will be dependent on the type of interaction, okay, on dE over dx. So you have excitations, okay, you create excited xenon atoms and diatoms, and then in the end, you get here two photons, a triplet and a singlet, that are pretty... they're not very well separated in time, 175 nanometers, and you also create charge. And if you don't do anything with this charge, you will have recombination after about 50 nanoseconds, and you will create more light, okay? Now, say that this here is your primary light signal. Say it's the S1, and the second one is your secondary S2. Now, S1 over S2, as I said, will depend whether you have a nuclear recoil, where you have a very strong recombination, or an electron recoil where you have a very good charge collection. So you can think of building a dual phase experiment, and this is how these dark matter experiments are being built now, where you have a liquid here and a xenon gas phase on top, and then you have an array of photomultipliers. Okay. Now, why is that? Well, the problem is that these nuclear recoils, they have a very strong columnar recombination, and you're not able directly to measure the charge. So what you want to do is to apply an electric field here to drift the charge out into the gas phase to have an even stronger field there and amplify it, and then we'll create electroluminescence, so you will have a secondary light signal that's strong enough so that you can actually see it. Okay. However, it's a challenge. You need an ultra-pure liquid. If you have some electronegative impurities in there, they will eat up your electrons. You won't get any secondary signal, so that's not good. You need to measure this very small electron signal. You need to measure very few photons because you want to go to a very low threshold. Okay, I put here 16 kV. Obviously, the lower you go, the better. You know, the higher your signal could be. Now, the xenon proposal is one of the liquid xenon. I've told you there's another one, Zeppelin, in the UK. In fact, there's a third one in Japan that's called XMAS, and they're all very similar. So you have, in this case, this is a modular design. The proposal is to have one ton of active xenon target distributed into an array of 10 TPCs. The R&D was funded, and we have now built a prototype, if you want, of 10 kilograms that will be installed in Gran Sasso in February. This will do some physics on its own, but it will also pave the way for the first 100-kilogram module, which hopefully will go down to this type of cross-sections, 10 to the minus 45 square centimeters. And this is just to show you some pictures that were taken very recently from the detector. This is an array of photomultipliers on top. You also have one on bottom. This is the innermost chamber. Then you have the field-shaping rings and so on, and the innermost chamber is made of Teflon because it has a very high reflectivity for xenon light, and so on. So this was now assembled. We are going to test it and then move it to the underground lab, okay? And then hopefully it will work. So how do you compare? It's a very crude comparison, but just to give you an idea, direct detection and accelerators, okay? Now in LHC, there's a general limit that people cite in the literature, namely 2 TeV for gluinos, quarks, and sleptons. The mass of the neutralino is about a sixth of those. So you say, okay, LHC, the reach goes, say, up to, depending, of course, a little on the model, but up to about 300 GeV. Okay, this is now excluded by accelerators. Again, you have to make some assumptions of the particle physics model to make such an exclusion. And this will be then the reach of ILC. You know, there are papers out there saying that it will be very hard for LHC to tell the nature of the WIMP and that you will actually need the ILC for that. Now, the direct detection, everything is excluded that's above here, okay? We want to go down here and maybe even lower. And as it's obvious from this figure, direct detection experiments are, if you want, cross-section limited, but they are not mass limited. So we can see, say, a signal that is here that is perhaps not accessible at accelerators, and vice versa, they can see cross-sections that are not yet accessible to dark matter experiments. So there's a complementarity between the two, apart from the fact, of course, that even if accelerators measure a signal, they cannot tell that this particle is stable and actually makes the dark matter. Now, there's a lot of talk about the SUSY benchmark models. For example, this is typical supersymmetric parameter space here, where you have these green regions are the one where the neutralino is a dark matter and the relic density is compatible with WMAP, okay? And then you can take different, you know, each point of here is one model. You can take one point and then compare, as these people have done here, how well can accelerators do or how well can a direct detection experiment do, okay? So this is, for instance, LHC, or this is LHC plus ILC 500. This is the probability density to measure the spin-independent cross-section that we are looking for in direct experiments, okay? And this is, they did a simulation on what super CDMS, the first phase, with 25 kilograms would do if you would see 25 events, if you get the mass of the particle from LHC. So that assumption is in there, okay? this just again to show you the complementarity. So if you don't have ISC and have only LHC, you need something like CDMS to do better than this. Okay. Now, how does it look for these other models that come from universal extra dimensions? Now, here you have somewhat fewer parameters, but so you have the scale. This is this 1 over r. That's about 1 TeV. And the cross-section on quarks depends also on the mass splitting between your LKP and the Kaluza-Klein quark. And because you don't know what this mass splitting is, you can take it as a free parameter here, okay, and plot this as a function of your dark matter mass, and then take these limits that I've shown you that come from direct detection experiment and plot them in here. Okay, so what can you say? Well, this region here is excluded, for instance, by the germanium data from super CDMS. Okay. Now, you can go here up to whatever masses of 2 TeV or so. This is how far xenon 1 ton would go in this parameter space. And this is how far, you can't see this very well, but the cyan line of super CDMS could go. Now, this contour here shows what's already excluded by WMAP in the sense that if you would have a dark matter candidate somewhere with this in this parameter space, your relic density would be too high, would be not compatible with WMAP, okay? So how much time do I have? 10 minutes, okay. So that we can talk a little bit about indirect detection. It's another huge field, and I'm not going to be able to say too much, but at least to show you what's also some recent results, if you want. Now, what you do there, you observe the radiation that's produced in dark matter annihilation, and because you have an annihilation here, the flux will be proportional to the annihilation rate and will be proportional to the density squared. So you need to know, if you want, your astrophysical uncertainties are higher because it enters here as a squared, and you also it's also proportional to 1 over the mass squared of your candidate. So you look at regions that are called amplifier, where these large dark matter densities, say, could accumulate, such in the galactic center or in the Sun and the Earth. And obviously from the Sun or Earth, nothing will escape apart from neutrinos. So you look for high-energy neutrinos above, way above, say, the solar neutrino background that comes from the Sun. Okay. Now, then, this particle will annihilate into all kinds of other particles, and they will then decay into electrons or positrons, proton, antiprotons, gammas, and so on. And you want to look for an excess of this type of particles above the known background. And it's easier if you look at an excess, say, of positrons and antiprotons than if you would take protons, because for protons, the background is way too high. So as I said, you have, again, these particle physics parameters that enter, like the annihilation cross-section. You need to know the dark halo profile, and it's not very well known, in fact, and whether it's clumpy or not. And you also need to know the propagation of these particles, of this annihilation product in the halo. So how do you measure gamma rays, where you can have ground-based telescopes, okay, where you detect the Cherenkov light in this ACT, atmospheric Cherenkov telescopes, such as HESS or MAGIC, Kangaroo, Veritas, and there are others, and they have pretty high energy thresholds, something like 50 to 100 GeV. And you also have space-based telescopes that have much lower thresholds. For instance, EGRET measured the gamma ray sky over 9 years, up to about 30 GeV, and GLASS, the next one, is scheduled to launch in 2007. And one of the goals of GLASS is to look for gammas from dark matter annihilation. So if you observe the galactic center, that's a region of high interest, okay? And there were observations of an excess of gamma rays from the galactic center, and this is the situation here before HESS. Okay, this is Sagittarius A, so you see that the position resolution wasn't so good from Whipple or Kangaroo there, and the situation improved quite a lot after HESS came around. So you can see here, they also measure an excess of gamma rays from the galactic center. Okay, you can see here they have a very good angular resolution here, and their their position coincides almost with the position of this supermassive black hole. So the question is this responsible for this excess of gamma rays? It may be, and there are lots of explanations. And there is also one explanation that says, well, perhaps these gamma rays come from dark matter annihilation at the galactic center. Okay? So in this paper, what they do, and this is a signal, this is a spectrum of the signal that's seen by Hess and this one by Kangaroo. So they fit this by assuming, or they need to assume, a very high, a very massive dark matter candidate in order to be able to fit it, namely 18 TeV. Okay? In the case of Kangaroo, they need to assume 1.1 TeV. So they're not quite compatible. Hopefully, there will be more data soon and we'll learn what's going on at the galactic center. Now, the diffuse gamma ray sky, as I said, EGRET has measured it over 9 years. There's a large catalog of sources. Most of them are unidentified. And the data is, in fact, free and available on the NASA website. And you can take it and analyze it if you want. And Wim de Boer, for instance, he published a paper where he says that, okay, EGRET sees a diffuse component. It sees an excess by more than a factor of 2 or so above the expected background that he claims is well known, namely from other processes such as pion decay or Bremsstrahlung or inverse Compton. Okay, so all the background together would give you this yellow curve. And this is the data, the blue points, right? And you cannot fit the data, apparently, if you don't assume here a WIMP mass or something like between 50 or 70 GeV. And they do this analysis by looking at 180 different directions of the sky, and they find they can fit it with the same background and the same WIMP mass. And they even go further, and they claim that they can reconstruct the halo profile from this data and the rotation curve of our galaxy. And that it agrees pretty well with the measured one. So we don't know. In any case, if this is true, then in this parameter space that I've shown you before, where I plot the scalar cross-section versus WIMP mass, then this is where this interpretation would be. So the good news is that with the 5 hours of CDMS, we can test it already. So the last point is WIMP annihilation in the Sun or Earth. Okay? So as I said, WIMPs have a very small cross-section, but yet there is a probability that it will scatter with nuclei and they will get trapped. And at some point, when the velocity falls below the escape velocity, they can settle to the core, reach equilibrium, and start annihilating. And these neutrinos are the only particles. Their mass will be something like, their energy, a third or half of the WIMP mass. They can escape and be detected. Okay? So solar neutrinos go up to 8 or 10 MeV or so, and these, depending on the WIMP mass, have much, much higher energies. And how you detect them, namely neutrino telescopes, by looking at these tracks, so you have a mu neutrino, say, it produces here a charge-current interaction creating a high-energy muon that then creates a Cherenkov cone that you can measure with such PMTs. For instance, in deep ice or sea or lakes or so with experiments like AMANDA, that is at the South Pole or Baikal, Antares is being built now in the Mediterranean, Nestor and Nemo as well, IceCube, it's the next phase of AMANDA, if you want, a much bigger version. Okay. And you also can look for these particles in underground detectors, such as the macro detector. This was a detector to look for magnetic monopoles in Gran Sasso or Super K and so on. And it turns out that so far, nobody has seen any excess above the atmospheric neutrino background. Okay? So this is most of your background. It's not coming, obviously, from solar neutrinos, but from atmospheric neutrinos. However, the atmospheric neutrinos come from everywhere, right? And then, for instance, if Super K looks, if this is the zenith distribution of these upward-going muons, then you expect your WIMP signal to come from here, to come from the direction of the Earth, right? You don't expect it to come from above, for instance. And the same thing here, if this is the angular distribution of these upward-going muons from the Sun, then you expect your WIMP signal to be somewhere here. And this is their data, and this is the Monte Carlo. This is the Monte Carlo without neutrino oscillations, and this one, the steps, are with neutrino oscillations. And you see, you can explain it very well without any need for a signal. And given this, they can give only give limits in this parameter space here. Namely, if you plot here for the sun, say the muon flux from the sun as a function of the neutralino mass, then you can say, for instance, this is the super K, this magenta line, that everything above here is excluded, and the same here for the Earth. Okay, and just to show you how it compares to direct detection again, the green points here were already excluded by CDMS 2004. So these plots are a little bit old. They are from 2004. They were not updated so far. So CDMS now obviously is doing somewhat better. And this is the prediction here how far Ice Cube can go, okay, or here. So I arrived at a summary. So what we hope is that with direct detection, we discover a leaked particle, okay, and we will constrain this parameter space, M and density times cross-section, okay, since we don't know any of them. And hopefully with input from LHC and ILC, namely, if we know from LHC or ILC what is the mass and what is the cross-section, we can determine what is the local density. Now, in indirect detection, the aim is again the same, discover a leaked particle, then you constrain this parameter space, sigma times the integral of the density along the line of sight. Again, if you have some clues on what M and rho are, then you can determine, hopefully, what is the density in the galactic center, what is the halo profile of dark matter, and so on. And, okay. So, I think the dark matter, searches for dark matter, it's a very exciting field. There are many new ideas for candidates. There are many experiments out there. The good news is that for the first time, we have reached cross-sections at the level of 10 to the minus 7 picobarn. Okay? These are very, very small cross-sections. No? And we are able to test some supersymmetric and UED and perhaps other models that predict such a weakly interacting massive particles. In the indirect detection, I've only talked about neutrinos and gammas, but we have several possible signatures or signals, if you want, and they have predicted wimp masses from 60 GeV to 18 TeV. Okay, you'd like to explain the dark matter perhaps with one single mass, so we don't know what's going on. In any case, the astrophysical uncertainties are much higher. As I said, we hope that LHC and ILC will discover something and will give us the microscopic properties of these dark matter candidates, and that this will help us to study the distribution of dark matter in the galaxy and perhaps understand how it formed, and then later on also in conjunction with n-body simulation, perhaps to understand the structure formation. So I stop here. Thanks. Right, in those SUSY predictions that I've showed you, the WMAP constraints are already taken into account. Yes, in all these models, they take into account constraints from cosmology, from accelerators, B to S gamma, and so on and so forth. Yes, so you only show models that are so far compatible with everything. Well, you are looking for such type. I mean, what type of particles would those be? Some type of cold gas or so? Then you would see some extinction of light from, you know, from whatever stars or so. So people have thought about many alternatives. Or other ideas are that maybe you have something like Jupiters or so, right? That you also you don't see. But people have been looking for this type of objects called machos. And they haven't found enough candidates to actually explain the dark halo or the rotation curve.
You also know the baryon density.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's again... Oh, sorry, you were talking about clusters, not galaxies. I mean, yeah, I mean, that's apart from that. You know an upper limit to baryons from Big Bang nuclear synthesis, and that's you already know that that's not enough. I mean, okay, I don't know. Some people claim that with all the baryons, you may even be able to explain the rotation curves of galaxies. So, I don't know. But it's not, yeah.